Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rethink Energy podcast. My name is Bogdana from Utime, the editor of Rethink Energy, and today with me I have Andrus Wontanar, our solar analyst. Hello, Andrus.
Hello.
In today's show, we will be discussing two of the items published in our weekly issue that went out yesterday. You can find these items that will be discussed and many more on our website, which is rethinkresearch.biz, that's B-I-Z. You click on Energy in Weekly Analysis. But this week we will be discussing, two of the items. One that Andrus wrote about the first new non-Chinese polysilicon factory opening in Oman, the first one in a decade. And then we'll be discussing one of my items, which talks about how Airbus is going to choose between hydrogen combustion and hydrogen fuel cells in order to attempt to decarbonize aviation. But let's get straight into it. Andrus, the first new non-Chinese polysilicon factory in a decade to be opening in Oman. Why a decade? Why did it take so long? And when? Where was the last one opened?
So I have to do a bit of a reverse ferret. The title of the piece says, first new non-Chinese polysilicon factory in a decade. Well, first off, I suspect that it will actually be owned and organized by Chinese and using Chinese expertise. It may even end up sort of supplying Chinese manufacturing, either going into or remaining outside of China, but like Chinese in terms of who owns it, some big mega corporation. Then it says, first in a decade. Well, I think it's the first in a decade, but to be honest, I'm not exactly sure. I'm pretty sure it is the first in that long that's totally brand new, but I'm not actually sure. Probably is.
I see. So why, if it's going to be owned by Chinese, Chinese company and using Chinese expertise, why not just open it on Chinese soil? Or is it just China making use of Middle Eastern funds?
Well, I think it's really about whether that counts as Chinese. Like we saw with selling modules and cells into the US, that it took, the US put anti-dumping rules on Chinese manufacturing in China back in 2012, and it took a whole decade before they decided to take a look at all the Southeast Asian stuff with a harsh outlook and say that half of it is substantively Chinese because it's going back and forth between China. Sometimes it's just a relabeling exercise. The companies are Chinese, the expertise is Chinese, a lot of the employees would be Chinese. So this is, so you can, even if your company and your expertise and your money is from China, if it's in a different country, that can go a very long way, even now, into being considered non-Chinese as far as trade barriers are concerned. And I think that's the main deal here. I think that is what it's about. And we don't actually know that this is being built by the Chinese. All we know is that it's being built by United Solar Polysilicon, FZC, SPC, an Omani company. And I can't find anything about them. Whoa. So that's kind of what. So it's a bit, one of the many things that is ambiguous and a bit weird about this. The other thing that's potentially wrong about the title of my piece, I do apologize. The third way in which it's clickbait is that I called it Polysilicon Factory. Now, I think it is. But the news is that it's begun construction. And the thing about polysilicon factories these days is, so a polysilicon factory really is taking metallurgical grade silicon, which is used for many different industries, and it's only 2%, it's only 99% pure, sometimes only 98% pure, so 2N. And it's putting it through the Siemens process. That used to take it up to 6N purity, which means 99.999%. Now it's probably up to 10N purity, which means 10, you know, 1/100 millionth impurity in the Siemens process. So there is, what's happened is as the demand for metallurgical silicon has increased from the solar industry, well, they had to start building their production capacity for metallurgical as well. And that wasn't really a problem because it's very cheap to make. The investment cost is lower than for the polysilicon segment. And also, it's so cheap that you don't really want to be transporting it because then the transportation costs ends up adding an extra significant fraction to the total cost of polysilicon. And probably most of the new polysilicon factories in China, which is to say the world, in the past 2 years, have actually been metallurgical as well. And they usually make the metallurgical bit a bit larger because you can always sell it to the other industries like organic or, you know, there's a lot of different ones. a very great deal. I think solar industry is only still maybe 15% of total metallurgical grid demand. So this is a polysilicon factory. It will have the Siemens process. And there's three ways that we know that. The first is the company's got solar in the name. Sorry if that sounds facetious. The second is that the investment cost that's been announced is $1.3 billion for 100,000 tons. Now, that is the investment cost that involves building the whole Siemens part of it. And the third reason we know is that Shuangliang Group supplied $58 million of equipment for the factory back in January, according to announcement, and it said it was high purity. So in other words, not merely metallurgical grade. But the reason why this is clickbait when I say it's a polysilicon factory, and by the way, everyone else has made the same mistake. I think it's a mistake. I'm not quite sure, but this is my analysis. I think they're actually only building the metallurgical grade right now. So the news is it's under construction. I believe they're only making the metallurgical part right now. And there's two things that make me think that. The first is that the Omani authorities have talked about making metallurgical and exporting it. Well, in a solar factory, you just turn the metallurgical grade into polysilicon on site, and then you export it as polysilicon. And I think the explanation for why this would be is that the polysilicon can't be sold in the current market conditions. So they're just building the metallurgical segment first. And then later on, perhaps after new trade sanctions on Xinjiang or China in general, that's when you bring the polysilicon online to dodge these trade barriers, to dodge the accusations about forced labor in Xinjiang, which, you know, if, depending on how the supply chain tracing works or doesn't work, is that it can implicate other Chinese provinces or China in general, even if the factory is in Inner Mongolia. How do you prove that? It depends on how the supply chain tracing works. It depends on whether the supply chain tracing is allowed by China or trusted by the West. So if that sort of thing comes in properly, then this is a reason for the factory to exist. So when the Omani officials report that it's actually going to be exporting metallurgical grade, this fact solves another oddity of this, which is that there's only 17 gigawatts of wafer production capacity outside of China anyway. So selling the polysilicon into China is just weird because there's so much overcapacity inside China of polysilicon. And also this idea that all Chinese polysilicon would be implicated hasn't necessarily panned out yet. So it's a bit early to be making an investment based on that. And the other problem is there's actually still 100,000 tons of existing non-Chinese polysilicon production capacity around the world. And that's enough for 40 gigawatts, which is more than twice the amount of wafer production capacity that currently exists. Another problem is that the wafer production capacity outside of China is not really increasing very quickly. Also, all of the stuff that currently exists is in Vietnam, just south of the Chinese border, owned by Chinese giants. And we saw PV cancel its 10 gigawatt plant in the US. We see NextWave, who I think are very interesting with the epitaxial deposition process, they're still only considering making a 6 gigawatt factory in the US. We actually have an excess of polysilicon outside of China already.
We have 100,000 tons of Western polysilicon production capacity, which is too much. So you have to conclude that it's too early to bring another factory online.
You can see why people are considering polysilicon factories in Oman, this one that's been announced as beginning construction. Also, there were two announcements in Saudi Arabia and UAE of considerations. I think one was from, I can't actually remember off the top of my head which Chinese companies they're from, but I've said it in the article. And there was Quinbrook Infrastructure Partners suggesting a really big one in Australia. But, you know, we're only at the stage where you can announce them. You can't start building them. So I think they're building the metallurgical section first.
Right. So, can this be then a case of Chinese companies eyeing IRA subsidies?
Yes, and Oman is probably pretty good. Like, if you build your polysilicon factory in the US itself, you do get the direct IRA subsidies. But maybe it makes more sense to build it in Oman where you don't get the direct subsidies, but you get lower costs for energy and land and everything. And, you know, then you're able to, like you say, put it into the subsidized wafer stuff because it's not it's not too Chinese.
That was quite, I thought that was quite an interesting story because of the ambiguity.
Yeah, I guess because it seems like from what you're saying, there's a couple of ways, there's a couple of reasons behind this this factor, potential reasons, but we don't know quite sure what the main one is.
Well, we don't know who owns it, and we don't know if they've actually begun construction of the polysilicon part or if they're just making metallurgical and they have a tiny little $58 million polysilicon equipment set up as a preliminary. I think so, you know, that's why it's fun. And there's rumors that a certain Longgen Zhang, the former CEO of Darko Energy, which is one of the biggest polysilicon manufacturers in China, there's rumors that he's behind it. But it's just rumors. Right. So there you go.
Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. But moving on to the second item that we will be discussing today is about Airbus, the aerospace giant. So they have a program called the Zero E program, which essentially is studying and trying to advance hydrogen-powered flight, whether that's hydrogen combustion or hydrogen electric, so fuel cells producing electricity using hydrogen. So they're trying to study those and test and advanced such technologies as an alternative to the sustainable aviation fuel route, which is something that a lot of other companies are pursuing. And the head of the department, I will not attempt to pronounce his name, but I did write it down in the article if you are interested. He took part in the Clean Aviation Annual Forum in Brussels, in Belgium, about a week ago. He came out with a couple of statements, and essentially said that Airbus is looking to choose to double down between hydrogen combustion or fuel cells. And to double down on those one of those technologies. He said that Airbus needs to select the technology before around 2026 or 2027, and it needs to at that point have a technology readiness level of 3 or 4, and that needs to increase to the usual 6 before an official launch later in the decade, around 2028 or 2029. With entry into service in 2035. So that's kind of the timeline that Airbus sees. And the similarities to those technologies, both would use liquid hydrogen stored in a tank. So that's the similar part. Both would require gaseous hydrogen. So you'd have to have a pretty complex pumping system that would take hydrogen from minus 250 something Celsius, bring it to room temperature, to become gaseous, and then feed it a fuel cell or a combustion engine. In the case of the fuel cell, you would obviously need a fully electrified powertrain with an electric motor. In the case of hydrogen combustion, that would probably look more like what's used today, gas turbine engines. The problem with that is you still have NOx emissions, so no carbon emissions, but you still have NOx emissions, which can be mitigated to some degree by catalysts, but never 100%, so that's a small caveat for you right there. What I said in the article is that our money really is on hydrogen combustion, simply because hydrogen combustion can do both short-haul and long-haul. Like today's aircraft, you have the turboprop engine, which is the one with the propeller sticking outside of the engine, which is your, you know, usual short-haul, national flight, so to say. Is very very popular here in Europe. But then you have the contained gas turbine that contains a nacelle, as a more typical jet engine, that's what people call it anyway. But that's your more typical gas turbine, which takes you on those long flights from Europe to the US and all around the world. But they can also do relatively short haul, 1 hour flights, hopping from the UK to Germany and back, or things like that. So the reason I'm saying we think that Airbus will most likely go down, if we are to believe what the head of the Zero E department said, that Airbus will have to choose between one of the two, we believe that it will go down the hydrogen combustion route, because that would satisfy both short haul and long haul. And he confirmed that there will be some degree of hybridization included in a hydrogen combustion variant, if that's the case. So some of the power will come in the form of electricity driving the gas turbine. He also confirmed that Airbus is conducting large-scale demonstrations on a 1.2 megawatt fuel cell system powering an electric motor. Airbus is not doing any demonstrations at the moment on hydrogen combustion, but he did admit that the area of interest, let's say, in the testing stage is the pumping system. Like I mentioned before, I suspect this is because you have to take cryogenic hydrogen from the tank and then convert it into room temperature hydrogen to put it in either the fuel cell or the gas turbine combustion engine, which adds a degree of complexity compared to today's airplanes, which use room temperature kerosene. They store it as room temperature, and they use it as room temperature in the gas turbines.
But which is the, between hydrogen combustion and fuel cells, which is the one that's more future-oriented?
Well, I think hydrogen combustion is further away from the present, but you know, what Airbus is saying is they want a hydrogen aircraft to enter service in 2035, and it's choosing between the fuel cells or hydrogen combustion. I think we will see.
So this is a long-term investment.
It is a long-term investment by Airbus. The thing is, there's plenty of startups already advancing fuel cell-powered aircraft. We saw this being tested on actual, on retrofitted airplanes. So that means you take an airplane, you strip it down of its powertrain, and you replace it with a hydrogen powertrain and hydrogen storage. You know, you put a battery in there for redundancy reasons. And we've seen actual tests on actual airframes done with fuel cell powered aircraft. Startups like ZeroAvia in the States, or you have Universal Hydrogen. Companies like this are advancing such technology. So fuel cell powered aircraft are, you know, already in the testing stage. When we're talking about hydrogen combustion, there's a whole new system that needs to be designed, tested, certified, etc. We're talking about fuel cell powered aircraft. That's really taking a fuel cell, sticking an electric motor on top of it. You know, I'm obviously oversimplifying it, but that's not.
So does that mean that gas hydrogen combustion is the better choice in theory in general, and it's just more difficult?
I mean, the way we see it, we will probably see both technologies. This is obviously, this is just what Airbus wants to do. I think we will see both technologies because hydrogen combustion isn't going to be ready probably, yes, until 2035-ish. Fuel cells will be ready before that. You know, whether Airbus is going to own them or not, that's a different question. But there will be companies who will be able to sell fuel cell powered aircraft before 2035. So we will see a fleet of those taken to the skies and attempt to decarbonize short-haul aviation as much as they can, as much as, you know, airline operators will be pressurized to buy into this technology. But we will see some. To what degree, that remains to be seen. And then hydrogen combustion will come after that, right? Because we don't actually have hydrogen combustion. I mean, whatever technologies they might have, obviously behind closed doors.
How will they actually even get the hydrogen onto the plane? I thought hydrogen was, it's not a dense liquid. Or is it? Will they cool it and have it really frozen?
Yeah, so.
Do we even
know? So liquid hydrogen becomes liquid at minus 250 something Celsius. So yeah, you need to cool it down to cryogenic temperatures, and then it becomes a liquid which has higher energy density than its gaseous form. And then you put it in a container and stick it on a plane. In simplistic terms, that's how they're going to do it. But they will want to do it in liquid form because gaseous will take too much space.
So minus 270 degrees definitely does sound like a future technology. Announced by, I want to say this guy's name, Matthias Andriamisena.
Yes.
That's from Madagascar.
Thanks for having a go there.
That, he's the head of their hydrogen.
Yes, well, I mean, look, the, you know, the rockets that we send into space, they use liquid hydrogen. So it's not that, you know, futuristic. It's been done in the, you know, 60s and 70s. But, you know, putting it on a commercial flight and having, you know, hundreds of those planes take off every hour, that's a different hurdle, right? That you need to throw all the certification hoops and safety aspects in order to actually get it from paper to reality. But yeah, we'll keep an eye on Airbus and any developments. Aviation is a topic that we do cover as part of our hydrogen coverage, so do keep an eye on that if you found it interesting.
Is that the first hydrogen combustion announcement we've seen for a while, or?
I mean, it's basically the, well, we knew that Airbus was working on hydrogen combustion, so it's not you know, the first hydrogen combustion announcement per se. We knew that they were working on it. They already announced that. But it was sort of a part of their, you know, futuristic, this is what we're kind of keeping an eye on thing. There's nothing, you know, there's not an official thing, you know, that's made public yet. I'm sure, I'm 100% sure that behind the scenes, they have designs and they have people working on both technologies, because this is how they're gonna choose, right? They start designing them and then they need to, you know, integrate a business case around them, safety, certification, and all that good stuff, and then make a choice. This is what this whole thing is about, right? They want to double down on one of them. And like I said, the reason I think that they're going to double down on hydrogen combustion is because that's going to cover long haul as well as, you know, short haul, just like burning kerosene covers short haul and long haul today.
And is this something that's specific to Airbus? So that this is how Airbus might want to get a technological advantage?
Yes and no. I mean, there's alternatives, right? Like I mentioned, the sustainable aviation fuel, which is essentially synthetic kerosene, so you don't dig it up out of the ground. You need a source of carbon and a source of hydrogen, right? So you take some, you know, on paper, some green hydrogen or some low carbon hydrogen. You take a source of carbon like waste, and you can make kerosene without digging fossil fuel out of the ground. So that displaces emissions from, you know, whatever emissions the waste you just used would have emitted in the atmosphere by, you know, rotting or filling up a landfill, etc. So that's the route that, for instance, Boeing is really doubling down on. But the problem with that is cost, you know, getting the price of sustainable aviation fuel down to even, you know, comparable levels to what kerosene states is quite hard, especially in the early stages. So there's you know, great polarizing opinions about sustainable aviation fuel in the industry, mostly regarding around cost. And then I guess the other alternative is, you know, battery electric, but then, you know, that's when energy density really becomes a problem. So it's not really a case of Airbus being the only ones looking into this technology. Like you mentioned, there's a couple of startups looking into hydrogen fuel cells, but yeah, in terms of hydrogen combustion, there's no one really on the radar at the moment that's pursuing that. But that doesn't mean that they won't, you know, we don't expect other companies. So it's not a case of Airbus choosing this super unique thing. You know, we see hydrogen as, you know, playing a big part in decarbonizing aviation. It's just a matter of joining in. But like I said, we cover aviation quite often, so do keep an eye on our weekly issue. Like I said, you can find the articles that we discussed and the rest of the articles that the issue contained in you know, as part of our weekly issue on our website, rethinkresearch.biz. That's biz. Go click on energy and weekly analysis. You also have a couple of forecasts under forecasts and data. Like always, if you want to get in touch with us and talk about anything, you can find our contacts in on our website or in the email that prompted you to listen to this podcast. We will be happy to reply to any queries.
And next week we'll be rejoined by Connor, won't we?
Yes, that's a good point. Connor is back from his traveling, and he will be rejoining us. And this podcast will resume its more usual topics, or rather we'll reintroduce some battery and raw materials or electric vehicles focused pieces that he writes. So to our listeners that are keen on such topics, those are coming back next week. So make sure to join us. As usual, thank you again for listening. We will wrap it up today. And like Andres mentioned, next week we will be back in our usual format of three. Thank you for listening, and we'll catch you all next week. Bye for now.